Hi, welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. For each program, we choose a new book that's especially interesting, and we chat with the author of that book. For this program, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jane Iwamura about her wonderful new book, Virtual Orientalism, Religion and Popular Culture in the U.S., which was published by Oxford University Press in 2011. In popular perception, a certain image arises when we imagine Eastern religions. Perhaps we envision a wise old Asian man in traditional clothing sitting in a meditative state. Maybe not. But why does this image emerge? Iwamura examines this Oriental monk figure in this new book. She outlines the history of popular representations of Eastern religions within the American religious landscape of the 1950s through 1980s. Over and over again, she found that the East was imagined through a particular perception of what Eastern spirituality was all about and how one could access it. She presents a short genealogy of this Oriental monk icon through the public representations of D.T. Suzuki, the Japanese scholar and popularizer of Zen Buddhism in the West, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the celebrity guru for the Beatles, and Kwai Chang Kane from the popular television show Kung Fu. In our conversation, we discuss the Zen boom, the hyper-reality of images, Jack Kerouac and the Beats, Alan Watts, geographies of East and West, and what makes American Orientalism unique. Without further ado, here's our conversation. Thanks for listening. Welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. This morning, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jane Iwamura about her wonderful new book, Virtual Orientalism, Asian Religions and American Popular Culture. Good morning, Jane. Thanks for talking with me.
Good morning, Christian. Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. Now, this really, I think it's a wonderful book. You know, the community of scholars who are interested in this subject seem to be praising the book. It's gotten a lot of attention. It seems to be that people are already kind of including this theoretical position of the Oriental monk in some of their work. And if I'm correct, last year there was a whole panel at the American Academy of Religion dedicated to the book. So it sounds like I'm not the only one who likes this.
I'm delighted.
Yeah. So we're excited to talk to you about the book. But before we get going, maybe you could introduce yourself a little bit about how you got interested in the study of religion, perhaps people that have been influential in how you approach religion.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. My background in religion goes back, I believe, to my childhood. I was raised in a Jodo Shin Buddhist family and community. And so from a young age, I attended temple and Dharma school. So that was really my foundation. But as many Buddhists living in the U.S. know, America is a very challenging environment to be a Buddhist, especially when I grew up. So this was complicated by the fact that by the time I got to junior high, my parents decided to send me to Seventh-day Adventist school. And that was followed by education in a Mennonite high school. And dotted in between there were a Catholic and a Episcopalian summer camps, and I had a turn with evangelical Christianity in college. So by the time I got to college, I had, you know, even though I had this Buddhist background, I considered myself a Christian. From this very kind of schizophrenic religious background, I think one often hears that you study what you're most confused about. So obviously religion was a topic that really fascinated me and that I decided to pursue in both college and in my graduate education. And it really opened my eyes, I think. By the time I went to do my graduate work at Harvard Divinity School, things had turned once again. And I really felt that what resonated for me was actually Buddhism. It was almost returning to what I had begun with. Even though I had been trained in the Christian tradition and Christian theology and philosophy of religion, my research interest turned by my master's degree, which led me to pursue in my PhD work on Asian religious communities. I had looked around to see if there had been anything written about the community that I grew up with. And while there were a few things, it seemed to be a real lacuna. There were certainly things written about Asian Buddhism, and obviously things written on American Christianity, but nothing in between. So that's basically what led me to study what I do.
And so how did this specific project come about?
Again, it emerged from my my own personal background and my research interest. And I looked around. Well, let me back up a little bit. When I was entering my PhD work, I had spoken with some of my mentors. And I said, you know, I would really like to focus my research on Asian American communities, basically religious practice among Asians here in the U.S. And what I would get was, you know, that is wonderful. We are so happy you're going to study Asian religions. They didn't quite get the American or U.S. part of that equation. And I kept bumping against this time and time again. And I, you know, sat down and I reflected and I said, why don't people get this? You know, what is the barrier here? And this led me to the Oriental Monk Project. I said, you know, even before I write on Asian American communities, I have to do a little work. And that work is basically understanding the perspective that Americans come to Asian religions with. How do they see Asian religions? How do they see, you know, different communities and different peoples practicing Asian religions? And that led me to virtual Orientalism. At this time, too, I was noticing that Americans had this fascination with the Dalai Lama. This was in the 1990s, you know, when there was much talk about Richard Gere and the Dalai Lama. And my sense growing up as a Buddhist was that there wasn't ever much interest in Buddhism among Americans before. And so I took these two things, and they really kind of informed the project. So it really started with a simple question, you know, what is fueling this fascination with Buddhism and specifically with the Dalai Lama? And from there, I tried to research and develop a cultural history of Asian religions in the U.S. And what you see here is what came of it is virtual Orientalism. The other piece of this puzzle, too, is popular culture. With my generation, I grew up with, you know, vision and beliefs. And I knew that, you know, while we go to college and learn about religion and, study religion from that perspective, we really get a lot of our information from popular culture. And this was especially the case with the media and the Dalai Lama. So that also added that dimension of the project.
Now, Jane, the title, this idea of virtual Orientalism, I'm wondering if you could kind of set us up here. How do you use this term Orientalism? Obviously, this has a wide-ranging kind of application. And then what makes American Orientalism virtual for you? What do you mean by that?
Yes. So my theoretical framework is very much informed by the work of Edward Said, just taking the word Orientalism and his, you know, groundbreaking book, Orientalism. And basically, Said and the viewpoint or definition that I adopt is it is this separation between East and West, especially in representation and discourse, in which the East has certain characteristics and the West has certain characteristics. And in our imagination, in our mind, the two are very separate. For instance, the East is often talked about with feminine metaphors, has a she, it has The East is seen as much more passive, much more peaceful, while the West is often talked about in dominant male metaphors and is seen as taking initiative and having a certain amount of power. And I think that we use this configuration of East and West all the time. So it's really key in bringing to our attention the way that we frame East and West in our imaginations. And this affects both, you know, our scholarly work and how we talk about the East and West in popular terms. So I found, you know, looking around and with my own interests, that this was definitely the framework that was informing much of Asian religion. That there was no way that we could think of the Eastern and the Western together. We can only think of Asians, you know, practicing Asian religions in Asia. And then as far as the West, it was often associated with Christianity. But if Buddhism came over to the U.S., it was often white practitioners with a focus of Buddhism. The virtual part I found is that now Saeed talks about Orientalism mainly in European discourse. And I thought, well, what does it mean for Orientalism? How is Orientalism manifested in U.S. discourse among Americans? You know, how does it kind of infuse the way we talk, the way we think about Asia and Asian religions? And I believe that really the difference between older models of Orientalism and a more kind of American Orientalism is technology and popular representation. We're in a new generation where technology plays a huge role. It's no longer the book that is the focal point or the means of communication. It is really television. It is movies. It is the internet that allows information to go back and forth in very kind of swift and concrete ways. Now, many people would think that this would break down barriers between East and West. We'd have more information about Asia. We'd have more information about Buddhism. We can be more informed global citizens. But what I found with the book is that what media often does is that it takes longstanding metaphors and stereotypes and basically concretizes them, makes them more kind of stubborn or obdurate. So while I thought there is certainly potential for greater communication and understanding, I also saw that, many of the separation between East and West, the stereotypes about the East were very much alive. And that is, you know, something that I wanted to conquer in the book.
So Jane, kind of the main, you use this word icon as a kind of a centering focus for the book, this idea of the Oriental monk. Maybe you could explain to us how you use this as a critical concept and what exactly this idea of an icon entails for how you approach your data.
Right. So the project basically started with from a very everyday sense. And so when I looked around and examined popular narratives about Asian religion, what always seemed to emerge was basically the same story. And not simply the same story, but also the same figure, which is the Oriental monk. There was always some type of monk that was very similar. Perhaps not the main so-called character, but a very important one. And as I began seeing this emerge again and again, obviously I had to really think through how this particular figure was operating. And at first, I think it was easy to perhaps think of it simply as a stereotype, because this monk had certain features, always a certain features. The monk usually was Asian. Let me give you a concrete example, which I feel that the audience might relate to. A very popular Oriental monk is Mr. Miyagi in The Karate Kid. And so you'll notice that Mr. Miyagi is obviously Asian. He has a very deep-seated spirituality. He's very calm. In addition, the monk is always poised, has a lone or lonely figure. He never has a community. So Mr. Miyagi, he has no family, you know, there's no, you know, Japanese American or other type of community. These are some of the features of this particular character. So when I really thought about how I was going to theorize this, I said, well, this is definitely a stereotype. So I was looking at these various Oriental monks, and I really felt that the way it functioned, I don't believe that many people who viewed The Karate Kid or other forms of these narratives, such as Kung Fu or, you know, later on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, really saw these different has stereotypes. I obviously wanted to call them out as such, but they really function in a much more type of positive manner. That is why I chose to call it an icon. It almost functioned as a representation, a religious representation, one in which people look to as a type of moral compass. And I felt icon capture that much more. Through the book, I wanted to lead the reader to see how that icon had very stereotypical dimensions. But I did want to focus on the fact that, you know, for many people, especially, you know, the everyday viewer, that when they engaged with these stories on television or in the movies or in popular print, they really took that figure as a model. And so often, you know, we think of icons more as like the icon of the Virgin Mary or the icon of Jesus. Well, I felt, you know, within the popular realm, the Oriental monk really functioned in this manner. And that was the reason the reason why I chose to position it as an icon.
Now, in the introduction, you talk about that in general, the American encounter with Asians was largely mass mediated. And mentioned this notion of stereotypes versus icons. Maybe you could kind of just give us a brief background of previous to what you see as this positive Oriental monk figure, what were some other kind of representations of Asians in American culture?
Of course. And I'm going to link this specifically to perceptions of Asians, especially in relation to religion. I would say before the 1950s, from the early 20th century to mid-century, the view of Asian religions, and specifically here, Buddhism and Hinduism, was often very suspect, if not derogatory. So in the late 19th century to early 20th century, Chinese were often seen as heathen. Bret Hart's popular representation of the Chinese as heathen Chinese was very prevalent. The Asian people were seen as almost a godless people. And this was obviously used against Asian American communities during that period. There were obviously benign relationships to Asian religions, but really Americans didn't embrace, say, Buddhism or Hinduism or Sikhism as, you know, anything related to their identity, right? This often goes along with viewing Asians and Asian Americans as perpetual foreigners, people who can't really integrate into the U.S., right, will always be seen as alien, aliens on American soil. Now, what happens, and well, let me back up a little bit. So from late 19th century to the early 20th century and into the Second World War, this view of Asian peoples and their religions is pretty stable. It, in fact, exacerbated, especially during World War II, when it comes to the Japanese. If you one looks at representations of Japanese Buddhism in, say, Life magazine, Buddhism is always seen as you'll be shocked, because I think right now we have a very positive image of Buddhism, but the way Japanese Buddhism is portrayed as, you know, very instrumental, that people are just, you know, sitting there. Why are they just sitting there? And obviously informed by the kind of malignant view of Japanese during the time because of the war. Now, obviously, the victor in World War II was the U.S. and the West, and there was the occupation of Japan in the 1950s, and you see a radical shift post-war. So where Life magazine had once talked about Japanese Buddhism in a particular way, what you see are these covers in Life magazine about Japanese style, about kind of a more open engagement with Buddhism, and Buddhism talked about in much more positive ways. In fact, Life magazine at the time during the 1950s had a whole series on world religions. So there was this kind of opening up to other religious traditions or world religions. But that only happened against the background of U.S. dominance and stability. And what you also see, again, in the popular realm is where you have these kind of very anti-Japanese kind of portrayals in U.S. film. You see a little of that in the 1950s. You see more friendlier, you know, versions like Sayonara or I'm going to get the title wrong, Tea House, the August Moon. Oh, gosh. But there are definitely more friendly representations during the 1950s. And so, again, you really see this shift. And what also happens during the post-war period on is you have the emergence of the model minority of Asians seen as being able to not only integrate into the U.S., but integrate and excel and sometimes even surpass people that have been here a long time. And I think really the recuperation of Asian religions and the model minority myth go hand in hand. So, you know, again, there's this pivot point from very negative representations and to shifting in mid-century to much more positive representations of Asians and Asian Americans. And that includes Asian religions.
This is really good lead into the first figure you choose as kind of an example of the Oriental monk. You talk about this figure, D.T. Suzuki. Maybe you could just briefly introduce who he is, and maybe why you selected him. Why was he important as far as this Oriental monk icon?
D.T. Suzuki was perhaps the most well-known popularizer of Zen in the West. He had traveled to the U.S. many times, starting from the beginning of the 20th century. And because of his proficiency, obviously in Japanese, but also in English, he played a key role in introducing a Western audience to Zen Buddhism and Japanese culture. Now, the reason he becomes a very important figure for this project and in the larger story is that in the 1950s, he receives a lot of attention by the popular press. Specifically, you'll find him emerge in popular magazines and news reports. And this is because he was engaging not only, let me back up here. When Suzuki came in the 1950s, he was really embraced by the elites in New York City. He had a visiting professorship at Columbia University. But at that time, he was engaging with well-known psychologists and musicians like John Cage and socialites. And because there was so much interest and buzz about Buddhism, basically, this was projected onto Suzuki. He became the figure that people entered into Zen Buddhism and Japanese culture. Now, he also becomes a key figure because Suzuki was extremely prolific. He wrote many books in English on Zen Buddhism and Japanese culture. And that's at that time, what happened that in universities, if you were taking a course on Buddhism, who would you read? You would read D.T. Suzuki. And so much of that foundation of what we know about Buddhism here in the West is highly indebted to D.T. Suzuki. So again, I'm going to jump back to the 1950s. And what I found is, you know, I knew that Suzuki had this huge influence on what we think of Buddhism here in the West. But what I was really surprised to see is that when I started, you know, researching and flipping through these magazines of time, flipping through Life magazine, flipping through the New York Times pages on religion, flipping on these different kind of media sources, that there was a time between 1955 and 1957 that Suzuki was, you know, highly featured to the point that he had a feature in The New Yorker, a very kind of long, extensive article and essay. And I was just really struck by that. There's also one group that he engaged with that was also key during the 1950s, and that was the Beats. The Beats really adopted D.C. Suzuki as their Oriental monk. Obviously, Gary Schneider was already much into Buddhism. But they, you know, Schneider was engaged in it and had known about Suzuki, introduced Kerouac to Suzuki. And again, he becomes kind of the moral leader or even spiritual guide for the Beats. This would wane in subsequent years. But during the 50s, this is how Buddhism looked in Beat terms.
Now, you mentioned in the book, and you kind of gave us a peek at it here, that intellectually Suzuki was very important. But in the chapter, you focus on how he was kind of visually presented to Americans. So how did Americans encounter him, I guess?
Part of my research looked at not only how Suzuki was written about in popular print, but how he was visually represented. And again, it was quite striking. If anyone looks into Suzuki's life and does more extensive research, they will see that, you know, Suzuki, for the most part, especially when he was, you know, in the U.S. in a kind of American public setting, you know, he always dressed in a jacket and a bow tie and very Western dress. However, you contrast that with the way that popular print decided that the basically the images they selected for the articles. And here, invariably, except for maybe one or two instances, he's always presented in Japanese robes. There is a real focus on his face. He had a very interesting face, but the photographs really capture that he was older, you know, and he just, the way they captured him was in black and white. Well, that was because of the media at the time, but always he looked very wise. And I think that was a very purposeful portrayal, that that representation would really capture an American audience. He conformed to the features of the Oriental and his like physical features, but also in the way he dressed as he was presented. He looked very wise and sagely. And that was, again, very much highlighted in these photographs.
Now, you talk about Suzuki's brand of Zen and it becoming a very stylized religion. What exactly about Suzuki's presentation made it into a consumable object?
Suzuki's brand of Zen was very attractive, especially to an American audience. It didn't require you to convert. It was very psychological and therapeutic. It made very little demands on the practitioner. And it was something that you could, more engaged, I think, during this period intellectually rather than in a strict practice. You know, even though Suzuki, I think, did emphasize practice, I think the way that he engaged the audience was always through books and through the intellect. So one could feel that, you know, you were reading Suzuki's works and you were really engaged in the so again, very little demands on the audience. So that was part of the attraction. When I talk about his presentation of Zen as stylized religion, what I really wanted to focus people's attention on was the fact that during the time that Suzuki's brand of Zen was being put forth, that it's buttressed by these images of specifically Japanese consumer goods. These are articles that Americans could buy, such as shoji screens, like cotton kimonos, you know, little tchotchkes you could put out your house that were Japanese in nature, that you could really kind of mark your individual style, right? So, and I think what I wanted to kind of put out there, argue, is that Suzuki's brand of Zen almost became a consumable object along with it. So that, you know, you not only have a shoji screen, you may have all these kind of Japanese articles in your house, but you can also say, well, you know, I'm really into Zen. So it becomes part of the kind of your consumable universe, so to speak. It also marks your identity, but it's an identity that is one, you know, that you can buy or you can easily adopt. And this kind of sets the path later on for the way that Asian religions are consumed. For instance, maybe perhaps a more relevant example for people is when we think of Tibet. Many people are into Tibet, so to speak. But they're not simply into the Dalai Lama or the Dalai Lama's cause, but you'll find that they can buy like Free Tibet bumper stickers, or they could, you know, buy a simple mandala that they hang in their home, or they might have incense. And all this becomes part of their world, but it's a world that has been constructed through consumer goods, and those consumer goods take on meaning and take on meaning, but also provide ambiance for religious and political commitments. So it's not that religion and politics and consumerism are separate here. They really work one in the piece. So Tibetan Buddhism gives those objects meaning, but the consumer objects also play into kind of marking our identity, that, you know, we have this kind of commitment to Tibetan Buddhism too. So again, they're one of the same piece. And really, that didn't happen just in the contemporary period that I'm talking about now, but all the way back. The groundwork was laid really with D.C. Suzuki in the 1950s.
Yeah. Now, the second figure you focus on is interesting, Buzz, because a lot of the same kind of phenomena is happening here. So you focus on Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. I'm wondering if you could just kind of tell us who he was, and perhaps how were Americans introduced to him?
Yes. So the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was a spiritual figure who founded the Transcendental Meditation Movement. And this movement had basically, the Maharishi had founded this movement in the 1950s, but it really didn't come to a Western audience until the 1960s. It's really interesting because if you look back historically, you know, in newspaper ads, you'll always find that TM and the Maharishi had always these kind of small ads placed in, say, the Los Angeles Times or the New York Times. So I think that his movement and he were always trying to make inroads in the U.S. and just globally. However, what happened in the 1960s, as we all know, is the Beatles. And the Beatles decided or really felt resonance with the Maharishi and Transcendental Meditation and really made this prominent during the late 1960s.
Now, Mahesh Yogi was, after this kind of encounter with the Beatles, we have him in a lot of types of media. But in the chapter, you focus on magazines. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of explain why magazines are unique as opposed to, in regards to other types of media. What can they do in presenting a figure like Mahesh Yogi that maybe TV or other types of things can't do? Why did you focus on magazines, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, at the time, I mean, obviously times have changed radically. But at the time, magazines were a channel by which many Americans engaged with the popular. Magazine readership was, you know, at an all-time high during the 50s and the 60s. And, you know, usually every household had a copy of Time magazine or Life magazine or one of these popular news weeklies. And the reason I really focused on magazines versus television, and this is, you know, this was a decision here because obviously especially the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, he appeared on television as well. He appeared on the Johnny Carson show, which is huge. So I have to make an admission here. part of the reason, one, is obviously theoretical, which I'll get to. But part of the reason I focused on popular magazines versus television was also practical. And the reason is I actually did want to pursue or look at very closely the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's appearance on Johnny Carson. Because similar to, you know, Life magazine, you know, many people, a wide audience, watched Johnny Carson. So this was, I was really excited when I found out about this. But as, you know, I looked at the footage, I found out that basically the footage of Johnny Carson during that period had all been destroyed. There are a few stills left from the show. I believe there are no transcripts. And so I really had no material to work with at the time. So the that kind of led me to magazines. But getting back to magazines too, I felt that it was a much more kind of engaging, it was a much more stable and engaging medium during the period. So for instance, like nowadays, if we watch something on TV and we're really interested in it, we can just, you know, go to Netflix, just go to YouTube and watch it over and over again, right? So we can have this kind of sustained engagement with, say, a visual text. And or, you know, if our friend says, oh, I'd like you, you know, I had saw this really great program on, you know, again, it's easy to bring up. Back then, that wasn't the case. You either caught it during the time it aired or you didn't. Whereas a magazine, it was there in your living room, you know, for a week or more. You could hold it in your hands, flip through it at whatever pace you wanted to. But, you know, you'd always, you'd usually sit for it for a much longer period of time or even go back to the text. So I felt that, you know, here was a medium that within very, very mediums that are very, that we engage with on a very, very fleeting basis that, you know, had a little more heft to it. And that's the reason why I decided to look at popular magazines.
Now, in this chapter, I really like this chapter. I actually used it in my class. And you go through a number of different visual presentations of Mahesh Yogi. And basically you're saying that through images, these magazines are making commentary, right? They're making
yes.
decisions, selective decisions, interpretive decisions. And you basically come up with counterpoints in relation to a couple topics. So you talk about how Mahesh Yogi's pictured in relation to pupils, into relation to things like technology, celebrities, or the idea of being a celebrity. Maybe you could just take one or two examples and explain how these counterpoints happen through imagery.
The visual image is fascinating to me, especially within popular print media, mainly because if you pick up a magazine or a newspaper or any type of popular print, that you might not read the story, but you'll certainly look at the pictures. And so that is another reason why I decided to really focus on the visual image. And when I happen to, you know, look at these images of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi during the late 1960s, they had a story to tell in and of themselves. You could basically see how the selection of images led to or culminated in a particular take on the figure. For instance, you could tell if the story had a positive take or a negative take on the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Or even within a picture itself, the visual often made a commentary. For instance, in Look magazine had a piece by Paul Horn and his trip to India as he followed the Maharishi. And one of the images is of the Maharishi with a camera in a crowd. And it seems like a fairly benign photo, but I feel that it's like, well, you know, there are many pictures of people with cameras and crowds. You know, why did Look magazine decide on this photo? And it became clear to me that there's a certain type of delight that the audience or interest that the audience takes from this image. And it's a juxtaposition here. Again, the Oriental monk, and Maharishi has an Oriental monk, is seeing someone who embodies an ancient wisdom, is almost from a time different than ourselves, from a time past. And so you have this figure who, you know, comes from this different time in our imagination, and he's holding up a piece of technology, the camera, and it provides this really interesting juxtaposition, right? it would almost be like, you know, the Dalai Lama sitting in front of a computer today, right? Anybody else sitting in front of a computer, it's not a very interesting picture. But you have an Oriental monk and what he represents in front or with or engaging a piece of technology. And, you know, it's this kind of startling, again, contrast. So I looked at each of these images and really kind of asked myself, you know, why this image? The image has to be interesting. It has to capture the audience's attention. It has to, you know, say something about the subject matter. And so I really kind of read each image with this in mind. Again, you know, we can never go back to the intention of the editors. And I don't necessarily claim to do that. What I do in the book is provide an interpretation. Why potentially might these images have been selected? Images are never, oftentimes we think of the images in magazines similar to like our iPhoto, where, you know, they're just there. Right. And they just tell a story in very transparent terms. But as anyone working on the other side of magazines and magazine editorial boards know, that they have to be very careful and they're very selective about the photos that they use. So I just wanted to, you know, work from that premise and, you know, kind of investigate what was going on with these selections of images.
Yeah, I think you do a really good job there. One of the other things that's interesting through these images is this notion of geographies. And what I mean by that is you kind of look at various presentations of when Mahesh Yogi is in the West and when he's in the East. Uh-huh. Can you talk a little bit about these like tensions of geography?
Yes. This particularly comes out when obviously Maharishi Mahesh Yogi traveled globally, and he made, you know, many trips to the U.S. and engaged an audience, especially during the late 1960s, a very large audience during his visits. And I felt that what was coming through the different kind of coverage of both his visits, but also of the Maharishi, you know, in his own compound in India, were kind of presented in two very different ways. So when you look at, say, his visit to New York City, there's often a separation between his Western audience and himself. I mean, there's a few shots where, you know, you see him in the arena or, you know, in the auditorium, and you see a Western audience looking at him. There's usually some type of separation. And oftentimes when Western meditators or TM adherents are the focus, they're often just seen meditating by themselves, you know, basically this kind of static shot of a few Western, and he'll venture to go as far to say white meditators just sitting alone. Now, in the Maharishi, obviously, they have images of himself, say, at the microphone talking to the audience. Where you see both together in those visits to the West is that the audience is almost, you know, you see these, they're young and they're very enwrapped and listening to every word that he's saying. Now, as far as the coverage in India, it really focuses on providing color to the Maharishi's life and kind of the spiritual outlook. So it's almost like a tourism spread. So you not only see kind of the Maharishi within his own ashram or natural environment, but it's almost as if a tourist is taking these pictures. You see kind of the local color. You see, you know, the Maharishi with musicians. You see him with painters. You see, you know, life in the ashram. So, again, these two very different orientations really dictated by where the Maharishi is placed geographically. And there's obviously a separation and orientation that highlights our distance from him, our distance from, you know, this kind of Asian religious outlook.
Now, the last chapter, you focus on this TV show, Kung Fu.
Yes, it's my favorite.
Maybe for listeners who don't know, you could kind of just briefly tell us what Kung Fu was and then perhaps why this is an important focal point for the Oriental Monk.
Kung Fu was a television series that ran on ABC from 1972 to 1975. It was a very popular series, I think, to the surprise of ABC executives at the time, and really took off, especially among families and young children. And basically, the series focused on Kwai Chang Kane, played by David Carradine. Kwai Chang Kane it's described here in the promo, he was a half Chinese, half American. Really what they mean is half Chinese, half white. Individual who grew up in China and spent a great deal of his childhood within a Shaolin temple and was trained in those spiritual and martial arts practices. Now what happens is that Kwai Chang Kane, while protecting his teacher, ends up killing the emperor's nephew and therefore has to flee China, goes into exile in the American West. And the show focuses on his kind of sojourn throughout the American West. It became very popular because, you know, for those who didn't live during this period, the Western was really kind of the dominant genre in kind of television dramas at the time, especially during the 1950s, 1960s. But it was also kind of on its way out by the 1970s. So it was a brilliant, you know, I don't think anyone kind of anticipated this, but it was a brilliant merger between the Western and a kind of Eastern. It was the genre of the Western and basically Eastern religions or Eastern spirituality, which of course kind of reflected a real kind of hippie sensibility at the time. So it's almost this kind of merger between what an older generation knew, the Western, and a younger generation was engaging with, which is kind of a more kind of youth culture, hippie culture, very kind of open to religious alternatives at the time. And so, again, I think if you talk to anybody who even was maybe a teenager at the time, everybody remembers Kung Fu. Of course, you know, people grew up later than that, don't remember it at all. But it was a very, very foundational show and basically laid the groundwork for, I would say, many of the martial arts movies that we see today.
Now, in this, you talk a lot about how Asian philosophies, religious traditions are presented. Mm-hmm. So what do we learn as an audience about these traditions? How are they presented to us?
Well, Kung Fu is a very interesting case because basically it is an American audience's entree into an Asian religious outlook. And I would say one of the first engaged entrees into that outlook. To the credit of the show, and I think it had to do this at the time, given its audience, it presented basically what it viewed as a Shaolin kind of philosophy, an Asian philosophy or outlook through the use of flashbacks. So when you watch the television series, Kwai Chang Kane, there's always a story going on at the time. that happens in Kwai Chang Kane's, you know, life in the American West. However, that particular story or episode is always dotted by flashbacks. And here, Kwai Chang Kane is remembering his training in the Shaolin Temple in China. These become the occasions to kind of educate or tell an American audience about, you know, not necessarily, say, religious terminology or theology. I wouldn't put it that strongly. But, you know, moral commitments, outlooks that, you know, are taken as Asian, for instance. And so these become very, very key. And the one thing that that happens in Kung Fu that doesn't happen in other narratives, subsequent narratives of the Oriental monk, is that, you know, these are fairly extensive, I would say, because the flashbacks, again, occurred not many times throughout a particular episode, and then you have many episodes culminating in a type of knowledge about the character, you also got a sense of his Shaolin background and training. And that, again, was a very kind of important introduction for an American audience into perhaps what they saw would be an Asian religious outlook.
So what, in your assessment, what does Kung Fu do for a popular American perception of Asians? Does Kung Fu challenge conceptions by Americans of what Asians are, or what Asianness or Asian traditions are all about?
I would say that is a very good question. yes and no. I would say more no. I'm very ambivalent here because the series, I think, did a good job at the time of presenting, it was one of the few shows that had Asian characters, and not simply Kwai Chang Kane. I mean, Kwai Chang Kane is supposed to be half Chinese, but really David Carradine is fully white. But it also included storylines with many Asian and Asian American actors that focused on the dilemmas that Chinese American communities faced at the time. So, you know, on that kind of episode by episode level, I think that it did challenge, or it brought to light somewhat of the Asian American experience. For instance, the movie that kicked off the series focused on Chinese American railroad workers and really was sympathetic to the plight of those workers and highlighted their exploitation, which, you know, I think for a television series is really phenomenal. On the other hand, so that's one hand. But on the other hand, you have Kwai Chang Kane himself and the way he's represented. And I think that's a more enduring image and unfortunately ends up becoming the stereotype. And the way that he's played by David Carradine is that he is a very calm figure, that he believes in nonviolence. So, for instance, in relation to the railroad workers, they want to really rise up at the time against, you know, the railroad bosses and protest their living conditions. You know, there's actually a figure who says, you know, let's get them, you know. And then Kwai Chang Kane becomes the kind of pacifying figure here for kind of revolution, so to speak. And he says, no, you know, we don't approach it this way. And he kind of breaks things up among the railroad workers. And he said, this is not the way to go. So he becomes this figure that there is only kind of one means of pursuing social change. And it's one that in which Asians are seen as, you know, pursuing nonviolent means, which isn't a bad thing, obviously, but also kind of very calm, very almost ascetic and serene, and very spiritual. And I think that, again, is what endures. Unfortunately, we don't have that tension that actually Kung Fu, to its credit, actually captured. We're just left with Kwai Chang Kane, pretty much.
Now, in a conclusion, you kind of allude to how this Oriental monk icon is still figuring today.
Yes.
And you title the chapter Spiritual Romance Today, which is really interesting because part of what you talk about is how kind of the spiritual, not religious, this Oriental monk figure is very appealing, and it's obviously enduring, and you give a number of examples. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you feel like in the long run, these type of Oriental monk figures are good, even though it's a somewhat positive image, certainly not a negative image. Mm-hmm. Is it a good image? What do Americans, how are they affected by this?
Yes. So, well, you know, it's been very interesting to see this when I was writing the book, basically I had children. So that put a whole new perspective on this. You know, and it was a wonderful perspective because I started kind of looking at what my kids were looking at and realizing, you know, I was looking at everything from Ninjago to, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to so many different examples of children's programming, and really found that this Oriental monk narrative was still very, very much in place. And not simply in place, but really becomes kind of the moral story that children learn, or the kind of vehicle that children, one, learn about a foreign culture, or this is, you know, they see diversity through this, but also begin to think about, you know, how to act ethically and morally in the world. So I just wanted to put that out there. And as far as its implications today, whether it's more positive to negative, obviously the pat answer is to say that, or I've heard some people say, well, at least it's a positive image. Right? You know, it might be a stereotype, but at least it's positive. It's not maligning, you know, a racialized community. You know, if anything, you know, Asians are seen in a very good light through this figure. But what I would caution against is the insidious ways that even positive images or stereotypes or particular instances of these icons operate. I still believe that how the icon operates is this kind of clear division between East and West, so that the figure or Asian religions is still seen as foreign. It's not seen as something kind of very much a part of American life. So, for instance, this is a bit of a side note, but a sidetrack is that oftentimes my children, I'll give you a very personal example. My children said to me, you know, so my son especially, and my daughter, because she watches a lot of things that my son does, my son said to me one day, he says, "Mom, you know, Do you know Kung Fu?" I said, "No." He go, "Does Grandpa know Kung Fu?" I go, "No." I said, and then we stopped there. And I said, "Why didn't you ask whether Daddy knows Kung Fu? My husband is white." And, you know, they thought about it. And they said, "Well, you know, because you're Asian." You know? And I think here is where the racial division happens through representation. Mm-hmm. And that is really, again, reified through these types of images. And also, I think that there's these types of narratives, popular narratives, also breed a type of familiarity. which can be good, but also kind of can be bad. And what I mean by that is I think sometimes, you know, especially youth, they really think they know what a Tibetan Buddhist outlook is, right? Or an Asian religious outlook is, because they felt like they've had so much of this engagement over television through these, you know, various TV programs or, you know, movies. And so they feel they really have a knowledge of this tradition that has been cultivated in not only over a long period of time, but in very specific contexts. And that leads to a type of feeling of privilege and kind of supremacy that, you know, it's almost sometimes, you know, and I engage in this, people feel that they know Asian religions better than, you know, people who study Asian religions. They said, oh, well, I saw Kundun, or, you know, I read the Dalai Lama's book. You know, isn't this what it's about? No, that's not what it's about. This is what it's about. So it leads to a type of familiarity that I find is frankly, you know, very dangerous, you know, and that erases much of the history of Asian religions, of Buddhism and Hinduism, and again, how it's practiced by different peoples around the world.
Well, Jane, we've taken a lot of your time, but before I let you go, I'm sure everyone listening would love to hear about some of the things you're working on now or things you might have coming out soon.
Of course, and I'll make this brief. I'm actually working on two projects at the moment. As I mentioned in the beginning of the interview, my real interest had been on focused on Asian American religions. Again, religion as it is practiced in Asian American communities. And so now that I've written Virtual Orientalism, I feel that I can return to Asian American religious practice. And one of the projects I'm working on looks at Japanese American home altar practice. So unlike how many Americans think of religious practice, when I looked back at my own background and specifically at my grandmother's, you know, my grandmothers really didn't go to temple or church all that often. But they were very religiously devout or very spiritual women. And so looking back on their lives, I realized that really what was the center of their religious life was their home altar. And I know this was the case for many Asian Americans. So I've decided to kind of look back at the history of the home altar or the butsudan for Japanese Americans specifically. And it brings up a lot of, you know, really interesting issues about just to kind of gesture forward to the project and why looking at home altar practice in this context is that, you know, during World War II, when Japan and the U.S. were at war and in which 10,000 Japanese Americans were interned here in the U.S., that the first people to be rounded up in these internment or concentration camps were Buddhist ministers. And this leads back to home altars because many Japanese Americans felt that they had to either, some people in some cases burn their altars, some hid their altars, because it became a symbol of Japanese loyalty and affiliation, and they felt they would be persecuted if they had that connection with Buddhism. So as you can see, the altar becomes this, you know, very fraught symbol. On the one hand, you know, I think many Japanese Americans have the attachment to the altar. I mean, it's very central to religious life. It also becomes an ethnic symbol as far as one's culture and one's commitments. But on the other hand, they realize that it also, during the war period, became a symbol of their disloyalty to the U.S., or potential symbol, I should say. So that's one project. The other project has to do, as you can probably read in virtual Orientalism, I really have this love of popular culture. And so my second project focuses on race, religion, and American film. And what I look at in this project, which is called American Dreams, Race, Religion, Race, Film, and American Civil Religion, is I became fascinated by a set of filmmakers of color that became very, whose films became widely distributed during the 1990s. And here I'm thinking of Spike Lee's Malcolm X. I'm thinking of Chris R's Smoke Signals, Gregory Nava's Mi Familia or My Family. And the reason why I kind of focused on these particular films is that they were the first movies that were, one, by filmmakers of color, and two, distributed widely and had a mass distribution across the U.S. Oftentimes, you know, there certainly have been filmmakers of color, but very few, you know, they usually, their pieces are often, you know, channeled along the more kind of independent film line and usually not, you know, huge blockbusters or, again, widely distributed. So here was a time during the 1990s that these filmmakers put forward their vision of how it was to be, say, African-American or Latino or Asian, I'm sorry, or Native American. I'm also looking at Justin Lin's Better Luck Tomorrow, or Asian American in that particular instance. So what I look at in these films is basically the civil religious dimensions about they're trying to really kind of play with, you know, what is it to be American? Not simply in one's kind of everyday life and lifestyle, but also I would argue religiously and spiritually. This obviously is most salient in Spike Lee's Malcolm X, but it also does emerge in My Family and also in Smoke Signals and in a very interesting way in Better Luck Tomorrow. So I'm very excited about that project. And the other piece of that I'll just end with is that the reason why I find this kind of group of films very interesting and this period very interesting is that what you see come 9/11 and the early millennium is that these types of films with not only filmmakers of color, but focusing on communities of color virtually stop. I mean, there's very little now. And these filmmakers themselves have had to go on to more projects with a much more diverse, if not white, cast. So what was it, you know, part of what's motivating the project too is to really investigate it. What was it about that period in the 1990s that really allowed for this kind of opening up of an American audience to different types of narratives about, you know, different, not simply different outlooks, but different kind of religious outlooks beyond, you know, beyond the pale, so to speak.
Well, great. Those sound really fascinating in two totally different realms of,
yes,
kind of research, but they both sound great. And Jane, thank you again for talking with us.
Thank you, Christian.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion. That was my conversation with Jane Iwamura about Virtual Orientalism, Religion and Popular Culture in the U.S., published by Oxford University Press in 2011. Thanks again.